Christians believe that the most important aspect of man's life here and hereafter is his relation to God and to his fellow man. While this is true, man's life is also set in an order of nature, which is God's ordinance, so that man has a fundamental duty to reverence the natural order, recognizing that God made it. It is a creature, not a thing. Today there is no effective Christian witness in relation to the temporal order. It is exploited ruthlessly so that it might gratify our whims and desires. Of course, there are national parks and game preserves, but these are a witness to man's rapacity and the result of laws designed to set limits to it. If effective witness in relation to the temporal order is to be forthcoming, a fundamental change of outlook is required by Christians in regard to it. We tend to exploit the physical world. We are part animal and so part of nature, dependent and interdependent upon the temporal order. We must reverence its economy. It is true we are called to have dominion over all the works of God's hands, but we must do so as senior partners, not as superior beings who are entitled by nature to extract from it that which merely gratifies our desires. The notion that the earth has a soul life of its own has long been a teaching of Latter-day Saints. In this connection, the following quotation by Dr. L.P. Jacks is of decisive interest. In his book, A Living Universe, written many years ago, he writes, quote, "There are in the last resort only two doctrines possible as to the nature of the universe, one holding it to be dead, lifeless, a mechanism going by a kind of clockwork, and the other holding it to be essentially alive, and that not as a cabbage is alive, but as we are, conscious of itself as a unitary whole and knowing what it is about. This is the doctrine which I find myself forced to accept as by far the better alternative of the two. The sayings of the gospel, 'God is not a God of the dead, but of the living,' I take as covering everything in space and time. All that the astronomers tell us that is going on in the unimaginable depths of space, all that the historians can tell us of what has gone on in the unimaginable depths of time, all is alive, and it is one life, frankly an immortal life, that animates the whole. If then there is anything in which I am at one with that universe, anything in which I am the sharer in its life, then too I become a sharer in its immortality. Life and immortality, not death and mechanism, are the key words of the real universe. And so far as you and I are true sons of the universe, so far as we reproduce its nature in ourselves, life and immortality are the key words to our reality also. When the universe is thought of in this matter, as living in itself, and it is only the accident of our times and the peculiar mental habits and stock notions we have developed which make it difficult for us so to think of it. When the universe is thought of in this manner, it ceases to be the mere scene or theatre on which our life is transacted, which is all a dead universe can ever amount to. It becomes essentially a companion, a living companion. No new idea, but one which was perfectly familiar to the Stoics and may be found running through all the writings of Marcus Aurelius. That being so, there is now room for raising the question whether you and your great companion are not fellow workers, out for the same thing, whether your purpose and your business are not one with the purpose and business on which the soul of the world is also intent." Unquote. All this is beautifully said, and it is the Christian viewpoint. In this secular world, Christians must stand for the proposition that man is grounded in nature. It is not only in physical nature that man's life is rooted, but he also shares a common humanity, which is also part of nature. There is a grave error characteristic of the times in which we live. It is that we place too exclusive an emphasis on politics as a means of solving social problems, to the exclusion of other equally important spheres of human life and activity. Man is not ruled alone by his reason and his conscious aims, and therefore his ills cannot be cured alone by adopting the right will and the proper aims. Our life here is inextricably intertwined with natural associations of family, livelihood, tradition, and culture. When, for instance, family ties are disrupted and broken, the whole life of society is thereby enfeebled. There are human considerations which precede politics. Although recognition of this fact should not be made an excuse for evading political decisions, political decisions of far-reaching consequence have to be made, and the way they are made will have a direct bearing on our social life. But there are spheres of human life which need to be enlivened and made healthy again, and in turn, these will affect political sanity and vigor. Until this secular age began at the end of World War I, most of the natural forms of association and most of the cultural patterns were sponsored to a great extent under Christian influences. Now new ideas of the nature of reality have taken the place of the old ones. Man's emotional life is being fashioned under entirely new rituals, and even where the aims are nominally Christian, the souls of men are molded by almost alien influences. It seems as if the real crisis we face is not a moral one, but a cultural crisis, and the remedy is not to be found in most of what the church is doing today, that is, in insisting on ideals and bolstering the will to follow them. Moral advice is important where it is not divorced from social structure. It is society that educates and molds the youth. Where exhortation and suggestion are at variance, exhortation always loses and suggestion always wins. As Dr. McDowell used to say, "What you are speaks so loudly that I cannot hear what you say." Many educators, among them Dr. Joseph Kinmont Hart, have pointed out that the chief instrument of education is the community itself. All of us are subject to a massive assault on our spiritual life from the streets, from the schools, from the mass media of communication. Not all these agencies are harmful, but sufficient of them are that they tend to determine the kind of people we are. If the Christian witness is to be more effective, Christians must recognize that community is the chief means of molding men, and that human behavior is determined as much, if not more, by subconscious egotisms, interests, and deceptions imposed by nature and man's place in history, as well as by his cultural patterns. This is illustrated by an experience of a friend of mine who remonstrated with a little grandson for watching so many bloodthirsty movies on television. "Jimmy," she said, "you don't want to watch all those killings." "But Grandma," he rejoined, "I love killings." The recognition that man is grounded in nature will lead those of us who are committed to Jesus Christ to create such environments in our homes as should testify of him. The pictures on the wall, the music we hear, the plays we watch, and the magazines we read should all be carefully screened in order that this total home environment shall testify of the Lord Jesus.